Today is May 8th, 2010, and this is episode 3 of FatCast. I am Leslie Kinzel of Fatchinista.com, and as always, joining me is Marianne Kirby of TheRotund.com. Today we are continuing part 2 of our discussion of last week about The Doctor. Every star of all, who's the one This is FatCast, and we are doing part 2 of our episode about The Doctor. So I guess this is actually not the same episode. It is a separate episode.
I really wish you could put the Doctor Who music in on this episode, though.
I know, that would be great. I'm pretty sure that there are copyright reasons why that would be a really bad idea.
I know.
But I do appreciate the thought behind it. But yeah, so we're still talking about The Doctor. We had a few more things that we didn't get to talk about in the first episode, and we're actually going to start with a question from a listener who submitted this question after listening to the first episode on The Doctor, and I'm going to throw it over to Marianne because this person was actually asking Marianne that question.
And I'm going to take a second to just say that it's really cool to get questions from you guys.
It's true.
It is so true. Interactivity. I love it. I'm going to read part of the question. There's some backstory that the listener gave, but the actual part of the question was, I was wondering how you got up the nerve to go back to the Doctor after years of avoiding it, and if you have any advice for others who haven't been in a long time. Not only am I afraid of the fat shaming, I'm also afraid that I'm going to be flagellated for not having had a pelvic exam in such a very long time. And let me tell you what I did. I like, the last person I saw was a general practitioner. I really love my eye doctor, and going to the eye doctor for an eye exam was like the least stressful medical situation I could think of. So I went and I got new glasses because I knew I needed new glasses. And I had this incident where my allergies and my asthma were untreated for many several years, and my then boyfriend moved in with me with all of his stuff and his cat, and we spent a lot of time moving things and stirring up dust and
carpet
and mold in my little crappy apartment, and I got really, really incredibly sick, and I had to go to the allergist. I picked an allergist based on very specific recommendations. I didn't just pull up a provider list. I talked to all of my coworkers and I asked them like really specific questions about the office environment. I had like 43% of my lung function. So, I mean, I really had to go. I couldn't walk across the parking lot. It was bad. So I hate to say it, but it wasn't so much getting up the nerve as not being able to breathe, which is a really fundamental action I have found. But I went to the allergist and had a good medical experience. They had the large blood pressure cuff. They weighed me, but they didn't seem to care about it at all. They just wrote it down for their records. And then they started helping me breathe. And so that kind of having a good medical experience made me start to think, okay, I haven't had a pelvic in a really long time. I can probably do this. So I once again asked really specific questions of people that I knew and got some recommendations and went to, you know, a gynecologist specifically for that. And I told them when I called that I hadn't been in a very long time, that I had had some really negative experiences with the doctor. And I told them all of that up front on the phone before I even made my appointment. And I think having that sort of open communication about it and letting them know kind of made a difference, because they didn't say word one to me when I got there about how long it had been. They just, you know, we did the whole exam,
mm-hmm.
and did, you know, the PAP and the tests and the everything, and then talked about birth control, and my weight did come up when we were talking about birth control, but not in a flagellating way, in a, you know, birth control, we're going to put you on this dose instead of this dose because you weigh this much. And I'm like, that, I can deal with that. So I kind of worked my way up to having a general practitioner who, again, I asked a fat friend who her doctor was and what that doctor experience was. And she'd actually had a negative experience in the office, which was kind of what convinced me to call this doctor, because she had had a negative experience and then she got like a handwritten note in apology.
Oh.
Because they took her like discomfort with the situation really seriously.
Huh.
And I don't think, like Leslie, I don't really believe in the concept of safe space.
Mm-hmm.
But I think an environment where you can go in and say, you know what, that really made me uncomfortable and hurt me, and then have someone take that seriously is a really, like, that's probably more ideal than a space that's supposed to be totally safe.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, sort of what the commenter's specific medical situation is outside of that, but I would recommend kind of easing into it. You know, ask around for some really good, strong recommendations. And then I would go in not for an actual physical or anything, but I would go in just to talk to the doctor and explain that it's been a little while, I've had these experiences, let's have an actual doctor-patient consult before I take my pants off.
That's
something I think people forget that they can do.
I think so too. I think that a lot of what can help in those circumstances is sort of managing expectations and, you know, sort of trying not to go into these situations with the idea that this is going to be the worst possible experience, but also going in knowing, well, I also have to be a little vigilant in terms of protecting myself and advocating for myself if I feel uncomfortable or if I feel, I mean, I have heard some true horror stories from women who have had things said to them during pelvic exams that, I mean, I joked last week about kicking a doctor in the head, but I mean, some of these stories about comments from really uncomfortable comments from doctors, yeah. That, you know, there is a point where you have to realize that this is, I'm not comfortable and I no longer feel safe in a way that is making me really scared. Not just, you know, sort of, well, that was weird, but like, wow, I really feel violated. And, yeah. You know, it's about sort of trying to strike a balance in your expectations that, if you go in expecting it to be horrible, you will probably be pleasantly surprised. That's true. But you will also have worked yourself up into an anxious lather, you know, prior to the meeting.
One of the other things I think people forget is that, especially in a consult situation, is that you can have someone with you.
That's,
you know,
true.
If you are going in to have a conversation with your doctor about how, you know, uncomfortable you are and how you are interviewing doctors, you can take someone along that will help you feel better. And, you know, sometimes that's what it comes down to, is just having some backup in the room to give you a sort of sanity check.
Yep.
And I know that when I am having a pelvic, because now I use my general practitioner for that, there's always someone in the room for that as well. Like from the office,
mm-hmm.
just kind of there so that everything is on record, everything is professional.
Yeah, you know, that used to happen to me when I first started seeing my current doctor, and it used to sort of blow my mind a little bit that I always kind of wondered if it was because he was a guy and maybe they like to have a woman in the room, I guess, just to keep an eye on him. I don't know. But it was weird because it would be like, okay, pelvic time, legs spread. Oh, here comes a nurse. Who's just going to sort of watch it happen and, you know, doesn't assist, doesn't do anything, literally just would stand there like a chaperone and watch the event unfold. And
that's so funny, though, because my GP is a woman.
See, I don't know. I've wondered. I always sort of put, I never ask, and I should have, because normally, I guess maybe just that was a circumstance where this was in the early days of seeing my current doctor when I was still sort of very guarded and uncomfortable in the doctor's office. So I now will ask the most ridiculous questions about anything, and I don't care. At the time, I just wasn't comfortable doing that. But I always sort of assumed, well, maybe it's because he's a guy. But I don't know. I don't know if just some offices have a thing where they want someone else in the room just to check up and make sure, you know, everything is following procedure. It always used to sort of boggle me because they would bring this person in and it was never like, hey, do you mind if this person watches while I'm, you know, scraping your cervix? It was always, oh, so-and-so is just going to sort of, you know, come in for this. And like I said, it actually made me more uncomfortable because I always sort of felt like this is a little private. This is sort of a private thing.
We're having an intimate moment.
I mean, you really are. And, you know, I don't know.
It's not quite a threesome.
I don't. Or some just a voyeur sort of situation.
We're earning that explicit tag today.
Yeah. It's so true. But yeah, I mean, it just sort of struck me as weird that no one asked, that it was never like, oh, would you like to have someone come in? It was just this person is coming in and is going to watch. And because I would have said, no, I'm okay. Just you and I. The fewer audience members we have, the better off I'm going to feel.
I think that this underscores how important it is to have a conversation with your doctor so that they know what you are comfortable with and you know what to expect, because that way you're not surprised by the third party in the room. Or you get to have the third party in the room
if it makes
you more comfortable. I mean, it really... I mean, communication is key. It's such a cheesy thing, but it's so true. I mean, the more we know about this, the more we talk about what you can expect in these situations. I know I went to my very first pelvic and I had no idea what was going to happen. And it's not like anybody sat down before I took my pants off and explained what was going to happen either. So it was this sort of, oh my God, what's going on? Kind of terrifying thing. And what are you're gonna put what where? And like, having experienced it, now I know what to expect. But going into, you know, these situations cold is really difficult.
One really great thing that I love about the internet, amongst the many things that I love about the internet, is that now when I have a question about a procedure or a test or whatever, I can go consult the internet and find a million stories from from a million different people who have had whatever it was done and talking about their experiences. So going back to the whole transvaginal ultrasound thing, when I had that done, I was, you know, leading up to it, and I'm a compulsive research person regardless, like, no matter what, even before the internet.
Sounds like a party.
Even before
transvaginal.
Even before the Transvaginal Express. even before the internets were as useful as they are today, I was a compulsive research kind of person. So now I'm worse than ever. And going into this experience, I was sort of nervous about it because I had heard some horror stories from people and I wasn't sure what to believe. And I talked to my mom, and my mom was like, it's better than a pelvic. And I, you know, sort of was trying to envision the experience in my head. And by looking up stories from people, it gave me such a clear picture of what was going to happen. That, oh, you come in and you have to have a bladder full of pee. And then they do the top of the belly ultrasound in which they jam the wand into your full bladder as hard as they can. A bunch of people mentioned that. And after that, if you're lucky, they let you go pee. And after you pee, you come back in and they, you know, put this other wand and they put it up your business and they poke around in there for a while. And
Leslie, you should audio record children's books.
Thank you. Yeah. But you get my meaning. I do get your meaning. Before I even went, I had a pretty thorough idea based, drawn from a bunch of different stories of what I could expect in a vague sense. I mean, obviously different hospitals, different specialists will have different ways of doing things.
And you do have to be careful because you look things up on the internet and sometimes you find like the most extreme possible right. interpretation of a thing.
Exactly. I mean, the one thing to remember about doing that kind of anecdotal research is that people are way more likely to report when they've had a horrible experience than when they've had an awesome experience. So you sort of have to adjust for that bias in your head, that if you're reading a disproportionate number of people who are like, oh, this was gruesome, that doesn't mean most people think it was horrible. It just means those are the people who are feel more motivated to go and write about it online. People who are like, eh, no big deal, you're not as, you don't feel as compelled to go on the internet and say, oh, I had a transvaginal ultrasound and it was no big deal.
It was a total party. There were balloons.
Or it was awesome and rocking and there were lights and drinks and a DJ.
That would be great if you could get that done in like the back room at a club.
But yeah, I mean,
it's
that's
transvaginal ultrasound night at the club.
It's true. But you're right. I mean, that's sort of, that can be helpful in terms of if you can get just a vague idea of what to expect if you're going for a pelvic for the first time in a gazillion years, if you're even just going for a basic physical for the first time in a long time and you don't know, well, what are they going to want to do? It helps to sort of look up the standards.
I went for a physical and it was one of my bad doctor experiences. I went for a physical and he pulled like an EKG machine out of nowhere.
And what did you do?
I was like 21 years old. I had no idea what to do, so I let him stick all of this stuff all over me, and then I had an EKG reading at a physical at my first time seeing this doctor. No explanation why he had a portable EKG machine.
Wow.
It was just one of his things. So, you know, if I had talked to him,
yep,
I would have known that beforehand and not gone.
And it's true because there are so many differences between doctors that doing a consultation where you don't have the added pressure of, okay, we're going to talk and then I have to get naked, can be helpful, like you said, because it will allow you to ask questions that you might not feel totally confident and assertive knowing you're going to have to get naked in 5 minutes, but you might feel a little more of that confidence and assertiveness if you know you don't have to get naked and maybe you have someone that you trust by your side. And
I tend to think of it as kind of like internet dating.
Of like, course you would think of it as internet.
You meet in a coffee shop, you know, you've got someone to text message you with a false emergency if necessary, and you don't get right to the naked part. I mean, why would you get right to the naked part with this doctor you've never met before?
That's true. Indeed.
My metaphors work, Leslie.
They really do. even if they're occasionally creepy.
Is that creepy?
I plead the fifth.
I'm writing about zombies. I can't help
That's
it.
That's true. All right. So we also wanted to talk a little bit about the process of breaking up with a doctor if you have to do so.
See, my internet dating metaphor is making more and more sense now, isn't it?
I'm not dignifying the question with a response. Do you want to take on this subject to start?
I feel like you're implying something. No, sometimes you have to break up with your doctor. You can also look at it from a sometimes you have to fire your employee perspective. You know, the doctor works for you. And if the doctor is not doing what you need the doctor to do, which is provide you with adequate health care in a way that doesn't grind you down, then it's time to find a new doctor, which is never a super fun prospect, but better that than, you know, to continue to go to this doctor who is damaging your health instead of helping you build it up.
Exactly. And I do want to mention, we failed to do this last week, but once you have broken up with your doctor and you're looking for a new doctor, there is a fantastic fat-friendly health professionals list that I will link in the show notes. It's not incredibly immense, but I think that most sort of metropolitan areas of the country, you'll find
Are you saying it isn't fat enough?
It's not fat enough. I would like it to be fatter.
I would also like it to be fatter. And if you are listening to this and you have a fat-friendly health professional that you go to, submit it to the list, because exactly, that's how the list gets fatter.
And the list is not necessarily about doctors that are yay fat. The list includes notes and submissions from people who say simply, my doctor does not give me shit about being fat, or my doctor doesn't treat me badly because I'm fat. It's not necessarily doctors that are all about health at every size or anything like that, although that would be ideal. It's more sort of a resource to look for doctors that are less likely in other people's experiences to treat you badly, or where you're less likely ideally to have a bad experience.
Leslie, have you ever broken up with a doctor?
I have, actually. I have broken up with my doctor that I had during my gallbladder issues, which I just recently sort of relived on fashionista.com.
Happy 10th anniversary.
Thank you. It's a sad anniversary because, you know, my innards don't work the way they used to, but you know, it's sort of a milestone. The doctor, and I've written about this a long time ago, on fashionista.com as well, but I'll sort of rehash it as briefly as possible here. The doctor that I had during my gallbladder escapade was a doctor that I did not know very well. I had seen her, I think, once or twice prior to having my first gallbladder attack. My first gallbladder attack landed me in the ER, where they assured me that I simply had gastroenteritis, even though I kept saying I have had an upset stomach before, and it did not feel like this. And also the fact that I had been vomiting for about 14 hours straight at that point, but that didn't seem to matter. I went to see her because after I got out of the ER and I was quite sure that they had misdiagnosed me, and I did some research and it sounded an awful lot like gallstones. So I went to see her. She had a complete lack of a bedside manner. She was kind of young, very inexperienced, just was not sort of a cheery person to be around, was sort of monotone. I don't know if she had an issue with me being fat or not. I was very sort of upfront with her when we first met about, I'm fat and I don't want to hear about my weight unless, you know, as a general rule, when I come in, I don't want you to push weight loss on me. If you have something specific to say, then you can say it, but I don't want to be harassed about it. And she immediately seemed very standoffish from that point forward. And we had sort of this uneasy relationship throughout the gallbladder problem. She sent me for the ultrasound and they confirmed it. And then I would have to have surgery, blah, blah, blah. And I had this, went on this in for reasons to do with the vagaries of insurance. I wound up having to wait almost 4 months after my first attack in order to have the surgery.
Didn't get to eat cheese during any of that,
Didn't eat anything that had fat in it. And I mean that pretty literally. It was kind of dramatic the way because the attacks, and I don't know if people who have had gallbladder attacks are nodding right now. If you've had a severe gallbladder attack, it hurts like nothing else you can possibly imagine. A lot of women say that it's worse even than childbirth. It's supposed to be absolutely one of the most excruciating attacks that you can have. And when I'd had two of them, after the second one, I thought, I will do anything to make sure this does not happen again, even if it means spending the next 4 months not eating anything that has any fat in it at all, because fat and oil, that's it's connected to how your gallbladder works. Just trust me on that. That can, if you eat a fatty meal, it can inspire another attack. So I went on this psychotically rigid diet that basically consisted of like apples and applesauce and rice and baked potatoes with nothing on them and barely survived, you know, for these, you know, 4 months. Finally had the surgery, came back from the surgery. After I had recovered, I followed up with a surgeon a couple weeks later, went to see my regular doctor for the first time after the surgery. And this was before I was declining to be weighed. And I got up on the scale. And now I had spent 4 months on what was easily the most rigid diet of my entire life. I hadn't done it to lose weight. I had done it to stave off attacks, but I was eating almost nothing, and it was really sort of dramatic, and it took a huge emotional and physical toll on me. I just felt like crap all the time, and I was miserable inside my head because, you know, I mean, God, 4 months without a piece of cheese. It was insane. So I hop up on the scale, and I had lost 7 pounds in those 4 months of eating pretty much nothing. And my doctor, with this cheery disposition, turns and says, "Well, that's a good start."
Ew.
And I was like, oh my God, I need to find a new doctor.
Ew.
Yeah, so, and I said I was going to be brief, and I'm not, and I knew I wouldn't be.
We're not brief. That's why our podcast is an hour long.
But yeah, so after that experience, I was seething with rage after she said that. I seethed with rage the whole rest of the appointment. I seethed with rage out of the building and into my car and all the way home. And I broke up with her literally by never calling her again. That was just it. I had a copy of my medical records from her office because I had to pass them along to my surgeon in advance of the surgery. So I had all of my records. I had no reason to ever call or go there again. And I just cut that woman out of my life. I severed.
It's like moving and changing your phone number.
It really is. It really was. It was like, I don't ever want to hear from you ever, ever again. And one of the funniest things about that was that I had never seen a copy of my medical records prior to that point. And when I picked them up from my first, it was all of the records from all of my visits, which had only been a couple, obviously, at that point. And the first, like, sort of introductory paragraph said, "Leslie is a pleasant, obese female." And I don't know why I found it so funny that this doctor was like typing up her notes, and it was, "Leslie is a pleasant, obese female." And I'm glad you're laughing too, because I thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever read.
I think it is the juxtaposition of pleasant and obese.
Well, that was kind of what I said when I first read it, as I'm thinking, well, at least pleasant is the first word.
Yes. What she just wrote is, "Leslie is a jolly fat woman."
Exactly. Or Leslie, I mean, I half expected her to say Leslie is pleasantly plump when I saw a pleasant start in the sentence, but...
Well, I kind of like pleasantly obese as like the new morbidly obese. I'm like, yes, it is pleasant. Thank you.
Yeah, we should talk to the AMA about making that, you know, sort of the standard language that they use.
It's friendlier.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that's my big sad breakup story. And after that, I actually first started seeing my current doctor. In between I went to Planned Parenthood for pelvic exams and birth control for a couple of years, but the next regular primary care doctor I had after that, that wasn't at a clinic, was my current doctor. So once I found this person and started this doctor-patient relationship, I just have never strayed since. I got married. To extend your dating metaphor.
I met the one. That's not the only valid relationship model.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I'm monogamously partnered.
I think that's really illustrative of a totally valid way to break up with your doctor. You can just not go back. That is totally okay. You don't have to go in and give them a big explanation. You don't have to, like, post, I don't know, something on the internet, like publishing the bans or something. You don't have to do that. You can just not go. You can find a new doctor, and it is always good to have, like, your medical records on hand. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, you can get your new doctor to call for your medical records. You don't ever have to interact with that old doctor again. I've broken up with some doctors that way.
I think maybe your history of doctor relationships might be a little more intensive than mine.
I have never had anyone say that I'm a pleasant obese female. Excuse me, a pleasant obese female. You know what it is? I think I was spoiled in my early days. My mom's family lives in a small town, and when I was very small, I had this fabulous pediatrician, Dr. Ozaki, and we moved around a lot, and I had a series of shitty pediatricians, but I spent a lot of time, like, in the small town where my mom's family was and where Dr. Ozaki was, so he was sort of my go-to pediatrician, I guess. And I continued to see him until I graduated high school and during my first year of college. And it was okay. Like, he never lectured me about my weight. You know, I had been a fat kid, but at this point he was like 70 years old. He was pushing it a little bit age-wise before he retired. And I was sad when he retired because I was like, you know, he was a good doctor. I could trust him to take care of me. And so when I went to other doctors and I didn't have that, I can trust him to take care of me kind of thing, I just didn't go back to them. And as the experiences got more negative, you know, the gulf in between got kind of worse. The sort of, I guess, pinnacle of me breaking up with a doctor, I actually filed a complaint.
Oh, wow.
Because it was the EKG doctor. Mm. We had had this appointment, and he was telling me about how he doesn't have to do, you know, blood sugar testing on his diabetic patients to know when they're not keeping up with their special diabetic diet. He just weighs them. And And we had been talking about, I was working with a friend of mine who was sort of an amateur nutritionist, and he was trying to sort of get me to eat enough food. And so I was working with him, and we were, you know, coming up with, like, meal plans, and he had finally talked me into eating some semblance of breakfast, even if it was just some grapefruit juice in the morning. And the doctor sort of promptly undid all of that work by saying, among other things, that a head of broccoli should last me more than a week because what? I should eat that little of it.
But it's broccoli.
I know, it's broccoli. He really had a thing. He was what he was advocating specifically was an incredibly strict starvation diet. And that was not the right thing to say to me at that point in my life. So I went home and I posted to the Live Journal about it. And my Live Journal friends were like, listen, that's fucked up. And you can report him for that, because advocating a starvation diet for someone with a sort of ongoing history of disordered eating at that point as well, that's not medically reasonable.
Yeah.
So I researched my options, and I had, you know, meanwhile, his office staff calling me for a follow-up appointment, and I told them no, that I would find a different doctor, that I had not, you know, I can't remember the wording that I used, but it was something to the effect that I had not felt very good about our sort of initial visit. Mm-hmm. And I filed a complaint. And nothing ever happened. I mean, the point wasn't to like, oh, I'm going to get you in trouble now. The point is that if enough people file complaints, it is there on their record. And after a while, you know, after a while, things do start to happen.
Yeah.
With investigations and that sort of thing. But it has to start somewhere. And my complaint could be the only one sitting there against him. But it also made me feel like I had done something proactive. And then I didn't go to the doctor for like 7 years. But but at that moment, that was, it felt really important to get back some of like my dignity and my knowledge, I guess, that I was not the sort of lying fatty liar pants that he was sort of casting me as.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That was a sucky doctor experience.
Yeah.
The broccoli thing has stuck with me because I'm like, it's broccoli.
Yeah.
It's broccoli. Even like Weight Watchers will let you eat all the fucking broccoli that you want.
It's true.
You know? And here there was this guy telling me that like a small head of broccoli should last me longer than a week. Because that's how little food I should be eating. Because I was that fat. And I wasn't actually nearly as fat as I am now at the time.
Yeah.
So, good times.
Yeah.
So you can break up with your doctor anywhere along that spectrum. You can just not call them back. You can explain to them exactly why you don't want to come back. You can file a complaint against them. You can pursue legal action against them if you think that they have really, really crossed the line. But that can be scary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's just important, and this sort of goes back to what we were talking about in the last episode about advocating for yourself at the doctor's office, that part of that is realizing you have a voice and you have a right to draw lines. And if you feel really uncomfortable, or if you feel like, you know what, I'm not getting what I need from this doctor, and I have no hope, I have no real expectation that I'm ever going to get what I need from this doctor, you can just walk away. And as you said, you can do it with as much or as little information to that doctor as possible. Part of my failure to communicate to my doctor when I left why I was leaving was just, I was so disgusted by this sort of gruesome, hopeful, you know, oh, see, you know, you lost 7 pounds in 4 months, and it being the most miserable you've been in your adult life. Surely if you keep it up, think of all the weight you could lose. And that was just, it felt not only sort of embarrassing and patronizing to me, it also felt sort of irresponsible to me, because I'm thinking to myself that most of what I have done over the past 4 months has been what a lot of smart, intelligent, learned people on the subject would call an eating disorder. And it messes with my head the idea that because I'm a fat person, somehow eating that kind of an extreme, strict, near starvation diet is okay for me, whereas it wouldn't be okay for someone who was smaller than me. And that
is, I've actually spent like the last 3 days thinking about this stuff, because I did an interview recently on the subject of eating disorders and how you can be a fat person and display all of these characteristics and you're congratulated for it because mm-hmm. you're doing the right thing. You're doing such a good job, and you're not eating anything. You're eating like 400 calories a day.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And it sort of links back to, this is sort of was the quieter point to the Newsweek article I wrote, and is something I've said a lot about lately, is the idea that a healthy diet and trying to, I mean, healthy by whatever your standard is, and trying to maintain however much activity or exercise is okay with you. We have this idea that somehow that's only something you have to worry about if you're fat. And that's part of my issue with the whole campaign against childhood obesity, that, well, basically it puts forth the idea that only fat kids have to worry about what they're eating. and whether they're getting outside to play enough, when really it would be much more responsible to make the case that, you know what, all kids should probably get some basic information about nutrition and yeah. how to feed themselves, and that playing is fun, and that, you know, learning when your body for, you know, when you have kids who you will have kids who are incredibly active and have no restrictions, all the way, you know, down the spectrum to kids who have asthma, to kids who are disabled, to learn to recognize your body and when it's time to stop, or when you've gone as far as is okay for you to go, and not to feel shame about having limitations. That's not, limitations is not really the word I want to use, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Not to feel shame about when your body is operating in a different way than someone else's body
when
is operating.
When your capabilities are different.
Exactly. And that is really sort of a critical, radical idea that we don't hear much in culture. And I think this goes back to the, obviously this is sort of a variation on health at every size, but I feel like this idea that somehow if you happen to be thin, you don't need to worry about this stuff is really insulting and downright dangerous. That your health, if you're so long, because basically with all of the fat hatred that we hear on a daily basis from medical professionals, but from just mainstream media as well, the response is that basically you start to get the idea that, well, not only are all fat people desperately unhealthy, but that only fat people are desperately unhealthy, and that if I'm thin, I must be okay. I must be doing something right. And this is obviously a problematic idea for me.
There's this excellent, so there's this movie Dodgeball. My entertainment taste.
I've never seen it, so this is all you.
You know what? Dodgeball is really kind of like, okay, so Vince Vaughn is in it, and Vince Vaughn owns this gym called Average Joe's. And in the sort of special features, I guess, one of the things he is talking about is how, you know, they had to train for like the dodgeball scenes, because they're playing dodgeball, they're trying to win $50,000 in the international dodgeball championships. I won't go into it. But one of the things he's talking about, and he's got this like genuine surprise on his little Vince Vaughn face, he's talking about how he manages somehow to be both thin and completely out of shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, he had a magical realization. Because and that's exactly what he said, is that he manages to be somehow both thin and not have any muscle whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of intense dodgeball regimen that they did really sort of kicked his butt. And I think that really illustrates it. You know, even people who are thin sometimes don't realize that that doesn't make them healthy or strong or whatever the hell our code word is for not fat.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And also, dodgeball is really funny and y'all should watch it.
I think that segues nicely into sort of the last section of what we wanted to talk about today, which is, and this is a question I've had a bunch of times lately, which I think is sort of odd, but I also think it's sort of great, is hearing from medical professionals. I'm not even going to edit that out because that was hilarious. Medical professionals and healthcare providers who want to hear from me on how do I deal with fat patients, that they don't want to be a jerk, but they also, you know, are looking for some guidance in how can I deal with my fat patients in ways that are respectful, that particularly considering that so many fat people have had horrible experiences at one point or another at the doctor. So a lot of fat people will go into the doctor, as sort of the reader question talks about, with all of this baggage already. So they're already guarded. They're already expecting someone to come down on them. And
not like there's a class in medical school you take, like how to respectfully deal with your fat patients. I mean, maybe there needs to be, but there just is not.
Yeah, I think there absolutely needs to be. But yeah, you're right. Fat patients don't come with like special instruction manuals that you can hand over and be like, this is a little different than what you're used to. And I think for me, one of the biggest things that I would like doctors to do and nurses and assistants and anyone who comes in contact with patients is to think first about what you would do if the patient was not a fat person. So instead of constantly, there has to be a line between being aware enough of someone's size that you know to do things like offer them a larger robe or get the big blood pressure cuff, the leg cuff as they call it. There has to be a line between keeping enough of a non-judgmental awareness of their size in order to get the equipment that is suited for them, but at the same time, without the attendant assumption that everything is going to be hard, like they're going to be less compliant because they're fat, or everything's going to be harder for them because they're fat, or they're automatically going to have certain complaints or illnesses because they're fat.
I never want to go to the doctor and have weight loss surgery marketed to me again.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of a big deal too. Like, and it's the same sort of thing. Like, what would you do for your patient if it was just a patient of, you know, whatever size you think is ideal presenting with these symptoms and treat them that way? Like a regular person. It's such a radical notion. I don't know. It's not a radical notion is the thing that kind of pisses me off. I think that if doctors will start dealing with that instead of addressing weight as like the first and only issue that they want to talk about with you, they will find their fat patients to be surprisingly compliant and surprisingly like open and active in their own healthcare.
I've often sort of wondered, and having not been to medical school myself, I don't know. I've always sort of assumed that at least part of the training, it's somewhere along the line, that doctors get has to do with a bedside manner and has to do with certain parameters of dignity and respect that you want your patient to enjoy. I don't know if that's true. I've always sort of assumed that surely somewhere in all of the years of training that you have to go through in order to be a doctor, somewhere along the line, there has to be a psych course about dealing with patients and making them feel comfortable.
I don't think there is.
I don't know that there is. And like I said, I've gone through my life sort of on and off assuming that surely they would bring this up at some point. And not just because of fat patients, but because of all their patients. That, you know, in the doctor's office, there's always circumstances in which weird shit can happen. Depending
you know
on
what
you're in there for.
Look at like our sort of national idea of doctor right now is house MD. So, I mean, it's not like, I think it's probably not like your regular patient is going in expecting a warm and fuzzy bedside manner either. I think that's part of the sort of notion of authority that doctors have.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think that it necessarily that I would expect them to teach warm fuzzies in med school, although that would be awesome. I've always sort of thought, like, why wouldn't doctors have just basic training in, you know, sort of the psychology of vulnerable situations so that, you know, you could have a vague idea of, okay, this is a new patient. They're meeting me for the first time. They're probably going to be a little nervous. I don't want to assume that everyone, because you know what, there are doctors who are just socially inept and who wouldn't necessarily pick up on that, or, you know, who might not realize that a patient that they're about to give a pelvic exam is like climbing the walls with anxiety because maybe she has a history of sexual abuse that she doesn't feel comfortable disclosing. Right. I feel like a doctor that is a little more patient and a little more trained in that sort of baseline of psychology in these circumstances and in who's been trained to feel required, to feel expected to provide an atmosphere in which someone feels at least as comfortable as is possible, because everyone is going to feel somewhat uncomfortable and anxious in a doctor's office. I mean, that just goes with the territory. But to try to create an atmosphere where he or she, the doctor themselves, is not contributing to the anxiety in an active way. That sort of would be something I would like to hear and see more from doctors in general.
Yeah.
You have nothing to add to that?
I don't. I mean, it's just so like, yeah, co-signed.
And the other thing we sort of talked about was, we touched on before, was that don't make assumptions about the habits or the health of fat patients without actually talking to them about it. Don't assume that because someone comes in and they're wicked fat that they have knee problems, because they may not have knee. They may have knee problems, but their knee problems may also be as much genetic as they are owing to their weight. So it's important not to just sort of assume that if someone has even a health problem that you would automatically correlate with their size, not to just take the flying leap into, well, you need to lose weight. Because the reality is, even if that's what you think is going to cure the problem, that may not be something that all fat people can accomplish. And it, in fairness, might not be something they want to accomplish, and that's okay too.
I have a moment of anger.
Okay. I'm going to give you your moment.
Oh, thank you. If you were a doctor, don't ever, ever treat me like I'm a fucking liar when I talk to you about my habits and my health history and my life. Because the minute my doctor calls me a liar is the minute we are no longer involved in a cooperative health relationship. And I do get really pissed off about this one because, god damn it, that's not okay.
No. Yeah.
You know, when the doctor doesn't even ask and make certain assumptions about your lifestyle, that's not okay. When you tell your doctor about your lifestyle and they talk over you or ignore you, that is a giant red flag that this is not okay. And so I think that even if you think your patient is a big fatty fat liar, you need to shut your damn mouth. Like, you can think I'm a liar all you want, but if you want to continue to have me as a patient and to have like any semblance of a good doctor-patient relationship, you know, just don't go there.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's a big ragey point that...
Yes, I feel ragey. I'm like, oh, my God.
And a really, really important and valid thing that the minute you start telling a patient that basically, and it doesn't necessarily have to be you saying you're a liar. It can just be a dubious look. It can be anything that comes across as sort of judgmental or yeah, whatever.
Of course you do, hon.
That was good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean that's pretty much basic. That's basic dealing with humans in life stuff, I think.
You would think so, but I find that, you know, it's the stuff that, oh, it goes without saying, that really most needs to be said, which blows my mind because, you know, fat people too. But yes, you still have to do these things with fat patients as well.
Well, you have to ask questions. You have to say, do you exercise regularly? What are your eating patterns like? The person's body size is not necessarily a beeline connector perfectly exhibiting what their habits are. I use myself as an example all the time. I eat mostly vegetarian foods and I exercise pretty compulsively.
You and squash, man.
Oh yeah, man.
One of those winter squashes.
So good. But yeah, anyway, I got distracted for a minute there. But yeah, and it's you know, you have to ask me these things to know that I do them. And it's definitely, I mean, one of the issues that I know sometimes doctors may worry about is that self-reported information can sometimes be inaccurate. And that's sort of a valid thing to, you know, want to keep in the back of your head. But the reality is, all you have to go on is what your patient is telling you. So if your patient is telling you, yes, I do yoga 3 days a week and I, you know, try to eat a balanced diet and, you know, I'm lactose intolerant, so I stay away from cheese and that sort of thing. Actually, cheese is sometimes okay for people who are lactose intolerant. So like, yeah, milk and ice cream, I guess. just trust that, okay, they're telling you the truth, because you can't, you don't get, I can tell you definitively, if you question it or if you do call them a liar, that is not going to make them want to be honest with you if they are embellishing on reality.
And if somebody says to you, you know, I injured myself at the gym, maybe you want to consider that they injured themselves through exercise and not because they're fat.
Or because they were running to the vending machine.
Yeah. I mean, just maybe they tore that muscle doing lunges. Because yeah. Lunges are suck, man.
I hate lunges.
Me too.
But yeah.
That's mostly a balance issue. You know, I fall down a lot.
Yeah. For me, it's just that wow, this sucks at you. Doing this totally sucks. And I think I hate it. I would also add to this that if you have to bring up someone's weight, if you cannot avoid it, if you feel like it's really critical that this is a subject that you have a conversation with your patient about, do so in the appropriate context and with an appropriate amount of respect for that person. Let them have their clothes on. Let the two of you hopefully be speaking in chairs that are at the same level.
That aren't making your patient physically uncomfortable. That's another thing doctors yes. can do, is make the environment of their office comfortable for fat people. That means having chairs that don't have arms available. That means having larger robes available.
And
having the larger blood pressure cuff.
Knowing where the damn leg cuff is living in your office, so you don't have to spend 15 minutes going to hunt for it while your fat patient is sort of sitting there feeling like a giant freak of nature because you have to get the special giant cuff for them.
Yes, so I would also, from the personal humiliation files of Marianne, I would also like to say it's a good idea to attach those damn tables to the floor. People to sit on the very edge of them. And I'm just saying, I've never actually like had one tip over or anything, but that is like my fear.
Oh my gosh. Actually,
I'm like 300 pounds sitting on like the tiniest little edge of the paper covered table. Attach it to the floor.
No, I've totally been there. In my doctor's old office, one of the offices, for whatever reason, it wasn't bolted down. And I just, because I do this all the time, because it's just how I am, I just sort of fling myself up on the table without really thinking, like, you know, just expecting it's stable. And the whole thing sort of rocked back and forth like a ship on the ocean. It was it didn't fall, but, you know, I had a moment of feeling sort of seasick, like, holy shit, what did I do? Did I rip this off the floor? And, of course, a nurse was there to be like, oh, no, that one's not fastened down. But, yeah.
But you still, like, you have this moment.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things at my doctor's office, they have, like, these tables that go really low, so you don't have to climb stairs or hoist yourself up. You just sit on the table, and then it, like, pneumatically rises, or I don't know.
Like a dentist chair. That's interesting.
It is. Oh, God. Like, talk about, like, anxiety. My great-grandmother, bless her, used to tell me all these horror stories about going to the dentist during the Depression. A lifelong fear of the dentist.
I bet.
Yeah.
Depression-era dentistry is not something that inspires confidence.
No, not at all. Ooh. And I take the exact same strategy with the dentist that I do with other doctors, which is to call them up and be like, listen, I am not a normal person. I have this history. Just be nice to me.
I'm not like the other guys at school. But yeah, to bring this tangent back a little bit, I think it's important to realize, too, that fat people exist, like really like everybody of any size, exist on a continuum of awareness about themselves and their bodies and their health. You're going to run into some fat patients who are extremely sensitive about their size. Some may be seemingly oblivious to it. Some will just sort of be all back and forth along that spectrum. Some of them, like me, will be like, yes, I'm a fat ass, which is probably unusual in the doctor's office, but we exist too, who, you know, don't have, you know, a huge amount of fear or,
yeah,
of, or what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of dread of having the subject of our size brought up. So don't, you know, sort of keep an awareness of that, that the person you are talking to could be anywhere along the spectrum of consciousness about their body. And as we sort of talked about last week too, there are people who, because of long-term body hatred for whatever reason, who just don't want to see what they've got. They just don't want to think about it. They want to ignore their body. They want to ignore any potential health issues that are going on. And, you know, part of building a successful relationship with a doctor is building that sort of trust where, you know, a person who has a good, solid, reliable relationship with a doctor is going to automatically start paying attention to his or her health, because they'll feel like, wow, I actually have someone now that I feel comfortable talking to and trusting with this information. And that's really the most important thing. If you really, really care about the health of people, fat people and all other sizes of people, the important thing to you should be cultivating an environment in which people want to care about themselves and they want to be aware of changes that they're going through and they want to be aware of their own health as unique and individual as it is.
Absolutely. I think that they can do that by remembering that their patients are people.
Yes.
You know, all people, all sizes. I mean, you don't have to actually be fat to feel fat or experience body shame or have any of these issues too. Mm-hmm. I mean, going to the doctor can be a horrible experience for anybody. So I think that the more you remember that you are treating people, not medical problems, the more you will find that your patients really respond to that and feel comfortable bringing issues and being honest participants in their own healthcare.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have covered all of our little bullet points that we wanted to talk about today. Do you think we forgot anything?
I don't think we forgot anything.
That's awesome. We're getting so good about nailing these 1 hour conversations. And and believe it or not, people, we don't do outlines. We don't do anything. We just get on the horn and talk to each other.
The thing that you have to like understand, like why this is such a marvel, is that Leslie is a little crazy about this. Like, she is Google Doc outline queen.
That's true.
And when we were talking about podcasting, she was like, okay, what are our topics? And I'm like, we can talk about this. And she's like, what about that? I'm like, just stuff.
Well, I wanted to make sure, I mean, that's in this, this is just to get a little meta for, you know, to wrap this up. I wanted to be, you know, I wasn't sure how this was going to work out. I know you and I have great, awesome conversations, but I wasn't 100% sure whether other people would give a crap about listening to them.
Oh, I totally wasn't either. I just figured we would figure it out as we went along.
I'm like, I need a plan and a spreadsheet. And
I appreciate your bullet points so much. I just tend a little more towards the extemporaneous.
Well, that's part of why we vamp off of each other so well, I think.
That's right.
All right. Well, you have been listening to FatCast. This is episode 3, The Doctor Part 2. I am Leslie Kinzel.
I'm Marianne Kirby.
And thank you, as always, for listening. You have been listening to FatCast, Episode 3. The music you've heard in this podcast is by Olo Django off the album Swing and Dance. FatCast is shared with you under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license.